listener production.
Howdy, you are listening to part B of the Howie Games featuring cycling trailblazer Phil Anderson. Let the stories begin. Phil, you're a hard man to find too much about, but I spoke to various people, including the great cycling commentator Matty Keenan and a few others, and read a few things. I need you to put a few urban myths, either yes or no, to these various next stories I'm going to roll you out. You mentioned Bernard Hinault earlier on, who went on to win 5 tours.
Yep, 5 Tour de France's.
Did you offer him a can of drink during a stage?
Yeah, it was my my very first Tour de France. And it was that particular day that I was talking about,
yep.
Climbing up the day I got the yellow jersey.
Yep.
And I'd actually met Hinault the year before I was an amateur, or 2 years before I was an amateur, and I had won the amateur Grand Prix de Nations, which is a time trial down in the south of France, and he won the pro version on the same day. And so when they do the presentations, we're on the stage at the same time. And so I'd actually met him before, but when we were riding together in that last kilometres, and I was trying to put him into the fence,
yep.
or trying to slow him down, I didn't ask him if he recognised me from that 2 years previous. a couple of kilometres earlier, you know, it was a hot day, and I'd noticed, you know, I'd never been in such salubrious company before. I remember noticing that the riders in the front were sharing drinks. You know, they'd get a drink from the side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
Now the riders will worry about the doping and,
yes.
you know, suspicious, you know, whether there's, riders getting past, polluted drinks. And
yep.
so but back then you'd see somebody with a Coke or a drink, and I saw somebody crack a fresh can of Coke and hand it out, and I was on the side of the road. So I grabbed that can. It was all frosty on the outside. I was about to swig it, and I looked over next to me, and this guy, Hino, was there. And he didn't look in great state. He was suffering a lot. He had like froth coming out of his mouth, and he didn't look like the poster that I had in my wall back home. That's for damn sure. And so I thought, shit, he looks like he needs a drink, you know. And I turned to him and offered this, you know, as a gesture. And
A Coke.
And so, you know, and we were like, you know, there's only like 10 of us left, and you know, you could hear the crowds, and it was just going crazy. And he looked at me with this bloody Coke, and at that point I think he thought that maybe I was somebody out of the crowd.
Relating back to what you were saying before,
yeah.
Did he drink the Coke?
No, he just knocked it out of my hand.
So
you didn't
get the Coke either?
I didn't get the Coke either, the prick, you know.
All right,
but anyway, yeah, so first myth is it's true.
Right.
Yeah, so I offered him a Coke.
That is a true story then. Second myth, I can't remember who told me this one, someone from the cycling fraternity, and I actually can't believe this one is true, that there was a setup at some point in a race somewhere and you all pretended to crash.
Yes. Yeah, I'm not sure you'd see that nowadays, but back...
So this
back,
is true
back,
as well?
Yeah. It was on the last stage, actually, or maybe the stage before last.
Of the tour?
Of the tour. And, you know, the first week of the tour, there's always lots of pressure. Everybody wants to win a stage or win the Tour de France, and so there's pressure on, you know. Second week, it's all sorted out. By the time you get to the third week, at least the tail end of the third week, everybody knows their position in the race. You know, you're not going to have any heroics. You're not going to have guys, mm-hmm. you know, who are 2 hours down. They're not going to bloody win the tour or, you know, even, you know, try and win a stage. And so there's always the spirit in the bunch is a lot better than in the opening week. The opening week, everybody's just trying to kill each other. The last week, everybody's just more family. And so, You know, the stages used to be quite a bit longer as well. Like the tour often used to be over 4,000 kilometres. Now it's, you know, and it's possibly more exciting, the stages now.
So how long would a long stage
be? A long stage would be 250, 300 kilometres.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. I remember one time we had a stage at 340 kilometres.
Oh, started, Phil,
started in Lyon or Saint-Étienne and went to Crans-Montana in Switzerland.
How
it was
long
long,
that?
Right
how?
Across. So it went from the centre of France over, bloody went to the east.
How long is it, 340?
Oh, it takes like 8 hours.
Jeez.
It's just bloody terrible, boring bloody days, you know. And so thank goodness now, especially for television, you know, it's a lot shorter. They're shorter, more dynamic, you know, stimulates attacks. You know, people think that, you know, with a shorter stage, people actually think they can win a stage from the beginning, you know, because they, like
away.
This year they had a 60K stage. It was great. It was animated. It was fantastic. Yeah. Anyway, it was back to those bloody boring days. And so to stop us from going to falling asleep, you know, the riders would do silly shit, you know, just in the bone, in the middle of nowhere. You know, if it was raining, we'd all stop under a bridge or something and wait for the shower to pass, or, we'd piss off the organize, you know, the organization by, you know, just all stopping and turning right down a side street or something, you know. And suddenly, you know, the director who's like in front of the race, like waving to the crowds, looks around and sees this. Where's his right brake race gone? You know. But, yeah, there's one day we said, okay, you know, there's like a few of the patrons of the bunch got together, okay, this is bloody ridiculous today. Let's all stop and lie down on the ground. It would have been a huge crash. So sure enough, you know, right just before a corner, we all stop and get off and bloody lie on the ground with the bikes in the air.
Like you've crashed.
Yeah, like we've crashed, you know. And suddenly the helicopter comes down and all the cars come to a screaming halt and the mechanics are running out of the cars with all their wheels, you know, thinking, geez, it's been a huge crash. Never seen such a, you know, 150 guys on the deck, you know. So, you know, the ambulance buddy comes screaming down. So, so myth two.
Myth two?
Myth two.
Prove
but
it.
I don't think you'd see that.
No.
But they do stupid stuff now, like the champagne, you know, on the last day. You know, it's ridiculous.
Okay, third myth. I think I read about this one. It might have been online, which is never, you don't know if these things are true. A teammate who was crook in the guts and needed maybe had a touch of diarrhea coming.
Yes.
And you gave him some advice as to what to do.
Yeah, that's right. It's a story I've had to tell a number of times. And, yeah, there was a young, you know, it's possibly my third Tour de France, and one of my teammates, the young Sean Yates, he's a Pom, he'd had trouble the night before and, you know, wasn't even sure he could start. You know, I don't know if it was midway through the tour, and you know, he just had a really quick guts. He had the runs, and he came to me, you know, mid stage, and he said, "Phil, I've got terrible stomach cramps. I think I've just got a bloody, I've got to stop." And we're moving along pretty well, and you know, because. You know, if you've got to go number one, it's not such an issue. But, you know, if you've got to take a dump,
yes,
it's a little more complex.
Yes, So
anyway, you know, we're going along at a pretty good clip. So I said, no, really, you can't stop here. You know, you just have to, you know, you'll have to hang on. He said, mate, I can't. And he said, I told him, well, I heard once that, you know, when I first turned pro, I remember marvelling at the story that I'd heard from one of my old teammates that, you know, something to do with a hat. You got to bloody put the hat down there and and do the job and
into the hat.
Do it like that, you know.
While you're still going?
While you're still riding, yeah. Well, normally you'd stop, you know, go behind a tree or something, but the pace was on, you know, we're doing 50, 60 Ks an hour and... So he said, you know, he said, oh, it's really bad. And I said, well, if you want to give it a crack, you can use my hat. You know, I used to carry these bloody little caskets. So I passed it to him and he was looking over at me, you know, we're all going along and he eyeballs me and he says, just like this with a hat, you know, he's waving the hat. And I said, yeah, down the shorts. So he takes his hat and, you know, puts it down the front of his shorts, you know, because we've got the, like those bib shorts on.
Yep.
So he got it down there, and other people, other riders, you know, are starting to notice that he's either having a good scratch or something, you know. And I'm looking over there, I'm sort of nodding to him, you know, how's it going? Like, you know, you finished yet? He's down there, and I look at his face and he's kind of contorting his face. I say, geez, I can't believe he's doing this, you know. And you know, everybody's like starting to understand what he's doing and sort of drifting away from him. You know, it's sort of a bit of a downhill and it was kind of coasting. And, you know, and he's down there with his, you know, one hand on the bar, the other one down his shorts. And finally he says, yeah, now what? You know, and I thought, oh, shit.
I can't
remember exactly what. I said, just when you pull the hat out, just follow through and give it a bit of a scrub on your way out, you know. And everybody's like looking, going, what the hell's going on here, you know. And, you know, because he's kind of drifting a little bit in the line he's taking. And finally he gets out this bloody hat. You know, and he's got a full steamer on there, you know. and so he's taken this and he says, what now? I said, I'm not going to take it back.
I don't need that. Just
fling it. So he's taken the peak and he's just flung it and it's kind of pirouetting through the air and it's sort of sailing off sort of behind the crowd. And I look over my shoulder and there's like 50 people jumping for that hat.
Oh, no.
Mate.
Well, that's the third myth that you've confirmed.
Yeah, well, there you go, you see.
I want to read something to you now, which it struck a real chord with me, Phil, and I was reading this last night and I showed my wife some pictures. Forgive me, but I need to read you this. Not only was Phil Anderson a multiple tour and Giro stage winner and classics monster, he was without question an unassuming style icon. That majestic mane and the Oakley eye shades will be forever a signature of classic 80s fashion. Skippy wasn't afraid to throw as many tones of fluoro as existed back in the age of hypercolour T-shirts into his mix, enabled somewhat by the hodgepodge that was the jersey at the time. Red booties and blue gardening gloves. No worries, mate. Chuck a bucket on my head too. I'll pull it off. Somehow it worked. People need to Google your name because you were, as it says here, a style icon. Feel like you had the long hair and some real rude gear that you used to get around.
Yeah.
But you pulled it off.
Oh, well, I mean, some would say I pulled it off. Others would say, yeah.
It was the big hair 80s.
Yeah,
you look cool. You still look cool now today when I look at that. Everything old is new again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it was a period there where, oh, I was in the late 80s. I was on a Dutch team and they had a lot of Italian sponsors, and the Italians are very flamboyant in their choice of colour, you know, and a lot of it was, you know, team gear and you know, we just wore what we were given. But, you know, it's because we had Italian sponsors that they didn't care.
Right.
You know, purple will go with bloody green, you know, it doesn't matter. But, yeah, like now everything is... Everything's for television and, you know, everything's so calculated. You know, the Sky team, for example, you know, they spend millions on just designing the look and feel of their jerseys and how it looks, you know, from the helicopter sort of thing, you know, and how it sits in the bunch and how it looks from a distance and, you know, how it looks on the podium against different sort of backdrops and all that. You know, there was none of that.
Well,
it wasn't calculated like that back in those days.
I think looking at some of that stuff, it's far better than Team Sky. I reckon you rode, you were riding 13 tours?
13 Tour de France,
tours,
yeah.
And you won two stages but 10 years apart, which is, I think, what separates top-line athletes is those that can continue to perform over such a long period of time and have longevity, which are... You obviously did. Is it still a special thing to you now to be a stage winner of the Tour de France?
Yeah, no, it's, you know, it would have been nice to win more stages. But, you know, to be able to come back, you know, as a senior member of the peloton and win, you know, in a breakaway. It was great. You know,
like what's it like when you cross the line as a stage win in the tour?
Oh, it's pretty sweet.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a lot of work. I mean, you know, everybody there wants to win a stage, you know, sometime in their career, and you know, it's what gets you up. You know, it's what gets you to the start line in hope that, you know, you'll get to do that one day during your career. It's huge. I mean, you know, the ultimate would be to win the tour like Cadell had done.
Yeah.
Yeah, that takes a whole new sort of whole nother level.
I was trying to get a gauge on how well-known your exploits were at home when you were racing. And I came across a beer ad for Tui's.
Yeah.
I feel like a Tui's or two. And there's a song about you. And to me at that point, I thought, wow, it was obviously pretty big time. Because if you got Tui's ads about you, feel things are going okay. It's a great ad too.
One day he'll make world champion. Sure as his name's Anderson. The fastest man who ever rode two wheels. That'd be unreal. How do you feel? Can you imagine how he'd feel at the time? How do you feel? I feel like a Tui's. I feel like a Tui's. I feel like a Tui's or two.
It was a good ad and it was a lot of fun. You know, we made that in 85. You know, I was doing really well. We actually squeezed that in between a couple of races. We filmed it in Europe.
Right.
We put it, you know, I had 1 week between the Dauphiné and the Tour of Switzerland, and we filmed it then. And I actually won the Dauphiné and I won the Tour of Switzerland. We did the ad in the middle. So it was a big 3 weeks. And then it was like 2 weeks off, and then we had the Tour de France.
Right.
So.
And were you paid in money or in Tui's or?
Oh, a bit of both, you know, a bit of both. But, I mean, they didn't really play it. They played it in country Victoria. They didn't play it in Melbourne. They played it in Sydney.
Right.
Queensland, yeah. But, every now and then it seems to circulate.
Is there a line in there about – I should have listened to it again this morning. Is there a line in there about 17 straight wins?
Yeah,
16 what does that relate
straight
to?
Victories. Possibly, I think I had 17 wins. Well, they weren't straight victories,
right.
But in a season, you
okay.
know, it was a big – It was a big, big year. It must have been 84, 85. Yeah, no, it was huge.
More of Phil in a moment. The last episode of the Howie Games was our first attempt at a live podcast in front of an audience featuring one-of-a-kind Sam Willoughby, a BMX champion whose life was changed in a single moment when he suffered a spinal cord injury.
I went into my first Olympic Games self-coached at that point. I was doing all my own training. I went and lived in an apartment under the Storybridge Hotel in Brisbane by myself in the lead up, just because I couldn't ride the tracks by my house in America because they were blocked off for the Americans. And so I did a lot of it on my own. And I think just at the last sort of hurdle of it all, it just got to me a bit, the moment of it.
How do you
mean? I think just being there and realizing that it's, you know, this day is here and it's, you know, test day. Like today is at that point at 20 years old, I felt like a gold medal defined my life, and I rode like that. Yeah.
So do you look back on that now? Like actually, at the time when you walked away from London with a silver medal, in your mind, a success or failure?
Success. Yeah. Yeah. I think initially when I came across the finish line, I'd say I felt failure because it was just like I got second. But then you realise the moment of it. You stand up there on the podium, and you know, in your Australian tracksuit, and go back to the village, and you know, all the encouragement, and probably one of the most memorable things from the London Olympics was when I came into my room. I had three rubbish bags full of mail from kids, and that hit me like. In a way, that made me realise, oh, this is big. Like, this is a big moment. There's a lot of people watching this. And but it was special because it just felt like it was not that long ago that I would have written one of those letters, you know.
Thanks to all the positive, heartwarming feedback you sent through on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at MarkHoward03 about that episode with Sam. I'm glad the episode touched you as it did me. Alrighty, back to Phil.
When you were coming to the back end of your career, which is what you're talking about now, you were joined in the team by a young Lance Armstrong who's gone on to dominate the sport and, you know, he's seen as a great figure and a maligned figure all in one. What was he like as a young man coming in? Was it with Motorola?
Yep. Right. Yeah. So I was my last 4 years I was on Motorola. In the last 2 years, Lance joined the team. He came over.
So this is pre-cancer for him?
Yeah, this is all pre-cancer. So, yeah, so this is in the 90s. In 96 he came down with cancer, so it's quite a bit before then. So he'd just come out of triathlon, a very successful triathlete through the late 80s and into the 90s. And cycling, I think swimming was his strongest leg, and then got into running. The last thing he got into was cycling, and then once he took up cycling, you know, that really, he really seemed to embrace that. So yeah, this young kid, I mean, my first memory of Lance was we were having a training camp in Northern California, and I was flying from Australia, and he'd come up from Texas, and we were at the airport, and we had the team bus just sort of pick me up, and I was pretty buggered because I'd done the trip across the Pacific, and I was at the back of the bus sort of snoozing, and you know, we went around and picked up Lance from his terminal, and I was like just kind of dozing, and then suddenly I hear this person going, "Phil Anderson, I don't believe, finally I'm on the team with you," you know, and he's this young kid walking straight down the aisle of the bus to me, and he's just, you know, banging off all these statistics, you know, buddy, you've been pro for so many years, and your first team was this, and you won that, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he was so excited. He came right up in my space, and he sat right down next to me. Like, you know, I felt like a dead rat, buddy, after my flight. And he's just banging on about, you know, fucking what a hero he thought I was, and blah, blah, blah. And, oh, geez, can we be in the same room? We're going to training camp, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I go, Jesus, who is this guy, you know? And no, I knew of him from the year before. We'd done a race in the East Coast of the States, and he'd won a stage, and I'd seen him and thought, shit, who is this kid, you know? Everybody's like, oh, he's the triathlete. And but anyway, he said, yeah, you know, and he said, yeah, and I was reading about you, and you've just gone through an ugly divorce, haven't you? He said, my mum's just done the same. You know, she's going to come to the rest day of the training camp. You've got to meet my mum.
Right. Could have been the next in line.
Right. So yeah, so that was my first meeting of Lance, and yeah, we used to have a lot of fun together, and you know, he was a young, you know, he had so much enthusiasm and you know, so much energy as a young kid. You know, you'd turn up to a race and you'd sit down and have a team meeting, and you know, Lance, we think you can win this race today, and so you'd go out in the field, you go out and do the race, and every lap he'd come to me, can I go yet? Can I go yet? I say, no, we're going to wait for the last lap or something, you know, or two laps to go. He said, and every lap he'd come up, Phil, can I go, you know? It's like, no, shit, mate, just take it easy, you know, we'd look, let us do some bit more work here and we'll set you up, you know, and oh, no, I want to. just beautiful to watch, you know, and you know, obviously he got into some deep shit later on, but you know, which was pretty disappointing. But, yeah, you know, in that era we were pretty bloody close.
It's a tough thing because he was the reason I used to watch Tour de France. He's the reason I got into being
interested in cycling. Yeah, the guy's a believer, you know. Obviously, there's only...
Phil, can I tell you, I was on radio the day he went on Oprah and I was doing a sports show on Triple M called Dead Sea Legends. I was like, nah, he's fine. I was...
Yeah. Well, I was a believer, so was Phil Liggett. We were all believers.
I've discussed this with
and
Phil.
And the skeptics were always saying, nah, the guy's nailed. And I remember that Hamilton book came out. Yeah. I was reading that thinking, I don't know, you know, there seemed like there was some sort of conspiracy or something going on here.
How did you feel? Because I can remember it clearly. How did you feel the first 2 minutes of that Oprah show when you just said, yep, 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 to every possible substance known to science?
Look, you know, I mean, I think the coin started to drop leading up to it, you know, because USADA was starting to do...
Yeah.
You know, the big investigation and you know, these things were kind of lining up, you know, and there was bloody smoke. And I guess it wasn't until that show that, you know, I had to hear it come out of his words to really...
It was like a punch in the face, I remember it, because it was just...
There were a few of us that were.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, because then you have to bloody... it's pretty hard to swallow when you've been, you know... I felt like I was the only person left standing believing in it, you know, and I was trying to convince, you know, the media that, look, it's just a bloody, you know, they're just out to get him, the French, the bloody.
Did you see much of that in your time in cycling, doping and illegal substances?
You know, it was something that you heard about, and it was something that was sort of in the shadows, I guess. But when I was riding, when I was racing, I never believed those around me were.
Right.
You know, I didn't feel like I was being cheated by riding with these guys. You know, I knew you guys used to take some shit for certain events, criteriums, you know, exhibition events and things like that weren't really races. You know, and I just... bugger if I know why they would, because there was no, you know, they were just exhibition events and things. I didn't really understand it, but you know, for me, I mean, racing, obviously, you know, I was very serious about it, you know, once I got the yellow jersey, and once you start, you know, taking a role as being a team leader, you know, the responsibilities of going that, and you know, I became very serious in my approach. But at the same time, you know, another part of my life, another leaf in my life was going to start when I retired. I wanted to be healthy. I didn't want to bloody, you know, go where, you know, things would be compromised, or, you know, like I look at myself now, you know, I'm not as fit as what I was back then, but, you know, I'm enjoying life. You know, in a very healthy manner now, and I think it's because, you know, the healthy choices I made back then. And, you know, I look around some of my teammates, you know, they're all doing okay. I mean, some have struggled. A lot of athletes struggle with retirement.
Absolutely.
But, you know, just, you know, and some have mental health issues, I guess, because of that sort of transition, or they never really took it well. But, yeah, I don't think there's any that I've seen who have suffered, you know, because of, you know...
substance abuse.
Yeah, substance abuse.
So sitting here now, and we've gone through, you had a remarkable career, which is only part of your life, and obviously life is treating you bloody well now, which is fantastic. How do you reflect on that trailblazing life that you had in your sport? Because those that have gone beyond you, I know Greg LeMond sort of talked about the fact, reading a few quotes from him, he was saying, well, you know, Phil showed us that it could be done if you weren't a European. How do you reflect on it all now and your time in cycling?
Well, I think it's, you know, it wasn't something that I was, you know, looking for. You know, I've never really been one. I mean, it's nice to be first in the race, but I wasn't trying to be the first Australian or the first non-European or, you know, that's all a bit of a toss-up. But, I mean, it is significant, though.
My word, it is.
I guess. I mean, I, you know, I've got some great victories or palmaries and you know, made a lot of good friends throughout the years and you know, I feel very fortunate. You know, never took anything for granted, you know, because your career can be over in a heartbeat. And, you know, I retired on my terms and you know, in good healthy state, still reasonably young. And yeah, I think you know, there's a legacy there, and I think it's already paying off in that there's others that have sort of followed in the footsteps. And yeah, no, for me it was like a fairy tale, really. Like the Cinderella story. Every day was better than the last. You know, and to be able to you know, come out of it, you know, to be able to afford a home, a lifestyle where you don't have to toil too much, you know, I feel very, very fortunate. You know, now, you know, it's pretty well taken for granted. You know, there's money in the sport, and, you know, you don't have to be world number one or win stages in the Tour de France to be able to make a decent living out of it, which is great.
And you now are still involved because you take people on cycling tours.
Yes, yes. I take people over to Europe to different events.
Give me a website.
In Europe. It's philandersoncycling.com.au.
Right. So I can jump on there and potentially go on a trip to the Tour de France with you?
Yeah. We're not doing the Tour de France anymore because there's so many people doing that.
Where can I go?
It's, you can go to the Tour of Spain.
Wow.
Which is...
The Vuelta.
Yeah, the Vuelta. That's in September. Right. So that'll be... We're not doing it this year. This will be next year.
Yep.
So we're just sort of transitioning out of the Tour de France into do other ones, maybe the Giro, which is in springtime.
And people, you ride on these tours, obviously.
Yep. Yep.
So I would get to sit on the bike beside you for 3K before we got to the hills.
Yeah, there we go. We ride a lot more sedate pace, right, than going up that plateau.
What a fantastic thing to be able to
share a Coke with you,
right? And I'll take it as well. And you'll give me a hat if I start to get crook guts.
Yeah, that's
or
right. I always got a couple of hats in the pocket in reserve. But we just take people over there to you know, share the experience of riding some of the. Everybody loves the mountains. I don't know why, because that's where you suffer most. But,
yeah.
You know, these mountains are sort of monuments of the sport, so you can go over there and ride the Tourmalet or Alpe d'Huez or, you know, these big mountains. And, you don't have to be world champion to get up them. Just go over there and ride. And, you know, it's a totally different culture over there. You know, here where we, you know, you go out in the roads and you're battling against the automobile over there. You're highly respected. You know, it doesn't matter if you're on a granny bike or on a, you know, $10,000 racing bike. You know, you're treated in high esteem over there.
Because I see it, you know, I've thought a few times you get older, well, probably it's time to stop running and swim or ride a bike to have that lower impact sport, and then, you know, you see what happened. Like you had a pretty big shunt yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, last year I had about four, broke a collarbone, a few ribs, but there was no car involved there. It was just, you know, the state of the Great Ocean Road. You might have noticed when you were driving down here that, you know, there's quite a few bumps and holes and things like that. So
would you hit a pothole or don't know?
I don't know. You know, I was knocked unconscious when I hit the road or, you know, hit the side of the road. So it could have been, you know, it could have been a wallaby or, you know, kangaroo or something. I don't know.
You were wearing
it. It's a pretty quiet road.
You were wearing a helmet then as opposed to when you were racing. And you're about to answer a question from my young bloke. When I showed him a photo this morning, he's like, "Dad, where's his helmet?" You like, what was that? What did you have? What was the name of the little cap?
The casquette.
What's the casquette, the little material casquette, going to do if you come off your bike? Like, you were one of the first that rode in a helmet.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so, the casquette doesn't do anything. It's just a branding thing for your team, really.
Right.
It might keep a bit of sun off the scone.
So what do you think people think when all of a sudden you started riding in a helmet?
It was almost like when you turned pro, it was a rite of passage. You didn't have to wear a helmet, which is ridiculous, really.
Mm.
But, you know, that was always kind of because as an amateur you had to wear it, you know, it was part of the regulations. And but you didn't have to wear one training. But when you were racing, you had to wear one when you were as an amateur. And in certain countries you had to as well. If you're racing in Belgium, even as a pro, you had to wear a helmet. But in the Tour de France, you didn't have to wear a helmet. And then possibly it was about 82, 83, there was one guy who spoke English in the bunch. He was a Portuguese rider. Agostino was his surname. He was a good rider. He'd won stages and in the Tour de France, and in Tour of Spain as well. And suddenly he wasn't in the race anymore, and he'd been killed. He'd been killed in a bloody crash at the finish of a stage, and he wasn't wearing a helmet. The finish of a stage in Tour of Portugal, I think. And, you know, he was one guy, and suddenly, you know, one of your bloody colleagues isn't there, and he's just not there. He's bloody fucking dead. And so that really shook me up. You know, I mean, I didn't know him really closely, but if he was at the race, someone'd see him, say hi and, you know, have a chuckle. He spoke a little bit of English. I mean, my French, we sort of got through, but yeah. So from that time on, I started wearing the helmet more and more eventually I made decent money out of it because some companies saw that I was wearing a helmet and they came to me and said, would you consider wearing it? A hard shell helmet,
right?
You know, that was cutting edge back then. Big bloody thing, you know, like an esky.
Yeah.
yeah, that was good. So I started wearing the helmet, and certainly wouldn't consider riding without a helmet now.
No, I think we're at the natural conclusion here, Phil, which is where listeners to this show know I have two kids. The big penguin. Named himself that. His actual name is Mac, but that's the way he likes to roll. And he was impressed by your nickname, Skippy, or the Pickle, which is my 8-year-old daughter, Skye. And I asked them in the morning of the person I'm going to speak to, we have a look at a YouTube video or pictures, etc. And the first thing he said, Dad, why doesn't he wear a helmet? And I said, well, you should ask him that. And he said, no, I've got a different question. Normally I can steer their questions to have some relevance, Phil.
Yeah.
He was insistent today that this is the question he wanted to go with. So I'm not apologising for him. I said, mate, I don't think this is something Phil's going to be able to help you with. He said, well, Dad, I don't know until I ask. So this is you, Phil Anderson, facing probably the toughest question you'll get today from the big penguin.
Unicycle. Could you ride a unicycle?
Hang on. Here we go.
Hi, Phil. Big Penguin here. Because you're such an amazing bike rider, we saw someone riding a unicycle. Could you ride a unicycle? I would like to know if you could ride a unicycle.
That's what he wanted to know, mate.
Big Penguin wants to know if I can ride a unicycle.
Yes, because we saw a bloke last night riding one.
Oh, okay. Have you tried one?
No. Have you?
I've tried one.
Well, there we go.
I've tried one, but it wasn't something that I really embraced. Put it that way.
So am I telling him you can or you can't?
I'm on the fence.
Okay.
I reckon it's something I could do.
Right. If required.
Okay, but I wouldn't I wouldn't put an egg on my head or anything like that. I reckon we practice.
Okay.
You know, give me a challenge.
Right. We expect a video through in the next 3 months of you going down the gradation road on a unicycle. Hey, Phil, mate, I really appreciate your time.
So did the Pickle have one?
No, the Pickle didn't. She was on the way off to school, so I didn't get to get one from the Pickle. Most often I know the people that I sit down with and we haven't actually even met before. I've never even interviewed you, which is strange in this, but you've invited me into your house and you've kept me entertained for, an hour and 40 minutes, which is fantastic. What's it like to sit back and reflect?
Oh, no, it's good. I mean, you know, a lot of my life is reflecting, I guess. You know, people are always asking about what it was like back then. You know, and
well, I think there's a real fascination about it.
It's interesting how it all evolves, you know, because when you retire, then it's still very contemporary and talking about now and actually happening now. And then obviously as the years go by, the generations come and go, you know, because already now, like a generation of cyclists, possibly 10 years or even 8 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, some guys have longer careers, others shorter. But, you know, it's possibly already been 2 or 3 generations since I retired.
Yeah.
You know, and things change, you know. Even Lance is saying that, you know, he's kind of off the back as far as what's going on in teams. George knows a little bit because he's got his own team.
Hincapie.
George Hincapie. So he's a bit more relevant because, you know, he's got his own team, so he's got contemporary riders there. But, you know, you're going to, you know, just by reading cycling news or what's going on or watching the the TV is one thing, but, you know, knowing what's going on the inside's, you know, totally, totally different.
Well, mate, I really appreciate you coming on the Howie Games. I hope it was as enjoyable for you as it was for me. I guess next time I see you, you'll be riding a unicycle and the world will be
Yeah, that's right, because you live down...
Bowen Heads.
Bowen Heads, nice.
Yeah, okay. I'd love to do every podcast down here, especially with that little point down there at Kennet River.
Yeah.
Very, very nice this morning. Good on you, Phil. Cheers. Phil Anderson, as I said at the start, a down-to-earth, ripping Aussie bloke. Don't forget to check out Phil's website, philandersoncycling.com.au. That's philandersoncycling.com.au. All sorts of tours on there where you can go cycling with Phil. Thanks to Phil for his time and his wonderful stories. Darcy Thompson for putting this little baby together. And as always, thanks to you legends for listening. Until Thursday, October 10, with V8 superstar Scotty McLaughlin, peace and love.
And we can do it if we try, try, try. If we try, try, try. If we try, try, try.
Listener.